Yesterday, 12 men of this congregation went to Columbus, Indiana, where we joined with a total of 94 men in the study of our responsibility before God as men, both in the human family and in the family of God, to conduct ourselves in a way that would fulfill our destiny and be a blessing to others. And all of that, I suspect, might have been in Jeff Smith's mind when he chose the theme for the singing this morning. That's, of course, only a suspicion on my part. There is no suspicion about the fact that what I'm going to speak about today is a result of themes that were unfolded, discussed, and prayerfully considered yesterday. We have begun here as a result of the interest and planning of Brother Tom Stockton, a meeting every other Saturday morning of as many men of the congregation as will come, to study about our role as God has given it to us. I think it is no understatement to say that it is high time that men entered into training for more than an ability to read Scripture, to lead prayer, and to speak, take care of the Lord's Supper in an assembly of saints. We have been trained for that for a long time, customarily. But we have not been trained in the skills of manhood as they express themselves in our relationship to our families, and I might add, even in the family of God. Lead the singing we may, lead the prayer we may, speak we may. But I'm not sure we've understood what leadership meant. How to bear the responsibility humbly. How to bear it faithfully, enduringly, keeping commitments that at times are difficult. But that's our task. In 1 Kings chapter 2 and verse 2, David lay down and called his son Solomon to his bed. And these are the words that the chronicler leaves for us from King David to his son. Be strong, he said, and show yourself a man. David knew that the burdens he was conveying to his son would be heavy, and he knew that courage was going to be absolutely necessary. In a similar vein, the Apostle Paul, concluding his first letter to the Corinthians, said in 1 Corinthians 16:13, watch. Be strong in the faith. Quit yourselves like men. That series of about four words, depending on the translation, is one word in the Greek text. And it means to act in a manly way, to have courage. And it is based upon the word man, as in male man. Behave as a man. Someone has observed that he knew quite early that being a man was not something that happened automatically when he first was told, act like a man, when he's a very young child. And that's so. We are born as males. And we are equipped by God for our tasks. Intrinsic within us, there is the capacity. But intrinsically within us, there is not the skill nor the knowledge of how to achieve that. If we get that understanding, it'll come from our willingness to be manly enough to face up to the fact that we are under the authority and guidance of God who created us. It is not manly to resist the obvious, to reject the calling that is yours, to reject the destiny that has been given you as a man. It's sad, I think, today, and ironic. We have been so long in this culture under the driving influence of secular humanism, which just means that man is made the measure of everything. He's the big hero. He's the one that's going to do all the great things, and no one else is going to get the credit. We can do whatever we want to do. And as an expression of secular humanism, feminism came on the scene, not the desire and the requirement of fairness and justice in the marketplace, where people ought to be paid fairly for work done. That's not feminism. Feminism was the idea that the human race was homogenized and that male and female were just an insignificant distinction. As one feminist said, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. No need for a man because women and men are just not that distinct. The consequence of that, and we've been listening to it a long time, and it has had powerful impact in the society at large, and it's had powerful impact on us. A teacher in one of our classes of young people was struck by the fact that the young lady seemed to be very much influenced by the idea that women should aspire to a great vocation, to a career. But that was the dream. We cannot escape forces in the society that work on us. Now, let me tell you what it's done for us. It has created passive men who are totally disoriented without any sense of who they are or what they ought to be. And aggressive women who are miserable and unhappy and have no idea why. Confused and angry children who have no discipline, no direction, and no sense of identity. Because men have been robbed by this mindlessness of their manhood, women have been robbed of their womanhood, and children have been robbed of their childhood. You cannot fight reality. We are not the products of some mindless force that is still going on to what end we do not know. Men are men because God has made them so, and women are women because God has made them so. All our efforts will not enable us to change that fact. And I want to stress today that men are destined for leadership, and the Bible, unless it is a myth, gives the strongest kind of foundation to this idea. If we have misunderstood what that leadership ought to be, we have not misunderstood that it ought to be when properly conceived. Read the story in Genesis 2 and 3. Woman was made for the man. The man was created first. It was to him that God gave the garden. It was to him that God gave the charge of the garden to dress it and keep it. And then he said, it's not good for a man to be alone. I will make a help suitable for him. And then he made woman from the man. Not the man from the woman. And he said, this is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. And then he presented, God did, the woman to the man, which caused him to make that, I judge, excited and delighted observation. And then the woman was named by the man, because he said, she shall be called woman, because she was taken from the man. And in the Hebrew, the two words for man and woman are ish and ishah. Just as in English, they are man and woman. Which reflects the idea of man as the source of woman, as the mate made, the woman as the mate made for the man, woman presented to the man, the woman named by the man. And now this is the most significant thing of all. Responsibility. Responsibility. You know, it was Eve who was deceived by the serpent. Beguiled by the serpent, the scripture says. And she took the fruit about which God said, do not eat of it. In the day that you eat thereof, you shall surely die. Speculation has been made that it was Adam's task to tell her about that. I'm not sure that is true. I'm not sure that God did not address the woman at last, as well as the man, on that subject. For she understood that God not only intended her not to eat it, but not even to touch it. But it's the man who's held accountable for her sin. In Genesis 3:17, because you hearken to the voice of your wife. Where was your leadership? Where was your protection? Where was your concern? Where was your nurture? Why did you allow your wife to be drawn into this? Where were you when this happened? Evidence of that fact is in the 5th chapter of Romans in verse 12 and verse 16. And also in the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, where it's physical death and resurrection as opposed to spiritual death and resurrection that is the concern of Romans 5. In both instances, by one man, sin came into the world. And the man's identified as Adam. He's held responsible. Why? Because he's a leader. Now, if there's anything that we've misunderstood about leadership as men, it's the fact that it is a responsibility. You bear responsibility. I bear responsibility for the well-being and the destiny of many other souls. And that means that I must be able to keep my commitments and to keep my promises. All over this country, men are breaking their promises. And if things get difficult in a marriage relationship or in a home situation, they just simply walk away. Not one third of the men who walk away from children in this country are responsible enough to take care of them by meeting the legally determined child support. Men will father serial children from different women and do nothing about meeting the obligation. Bill McCartney, who was until recently the football coach at the University of Colorado, founded in 1990 an organization called Promise Keepers. They are intending, whether they succeed or not, next or this year, to have 1 million men gather in Washington, D.C., to affirm their determination to reverence God, to keep their promises, and to be the kind of men that God expects them to be. I'm not saying yes or no about the organization, but I'm telling you that that's the reaction to what's happening in this society. Just this past week, when I got Well, I didn't know about it until Sid told me. He got his copy first. When I got my copy of U.S. News and World Report, the front of the thing says, "Why Fathers Count." "Honor your children," it says inside. "Nearly 2 of every 5 kids in America do not live with their fathers. Now a movement is growing to repair the damage and reconnect dads to their children. Rich or poor, white or black, the children of divorce and those born outside marriage struggle through life at a measurable disadvantage, according to a growing chorus of social thinkers. 38% of all kids now live without their biological fathers, up from about 17.5% in 1960. More than half of today's children will spend at least part of their childhood without a father. Then from a book by David Blankenhorn called Fatherless America, Confronting Our Most Urgent Social Problem, these words, fatherlessness is the most destructive trend of our generation. The article goes on to say the absence of fathers is linked to most social nightmares, from boys with guns to girls with babies. We don't like that part, do we? We don't like this drug-ridden society. We don't like children having children. And especially we don't like because economic issues really get to us quickly. Even if we have no spiritual or social concerns, we don't like paying the bill. And we don't like the violence in the street. Not always because we're concerned about the mayhem and havoc it's working on the lives of others, but particularly upon being threatened ourselves in our private enclaves. We don't like that. And so this society now is ready maybe even to open its mind to the possibility that the reason that we're in trouble is because we have violated the fundamental precepts of the God who made us, and it will not work. We cannot arrange society any way we want. We cannot redirect the roles of men and women as if they were some sort of plastic arrangement like a wax nose that we can move in any direction that happens to please us at the time. Stephen Clark, a historian from Yale University, wrote the following words, "Men bear primary responsibility for the larger community. Women bear primary responsibility for domestic management and rearing of young children. Every known society, past or present, assigns to the men a primary responsibility for the government of the larger groupings within the society and assigns to the woman or women a primary responsibility for the daily maintenance of household units and the care of the younger children." I'm sure feminists did not like to read that, and it's surprising coming from Yale University. But if a man might write that and thought of as being skewed in his judgment of things, Sherry Ortner, who is a feminist scholar, stated, "The universality of female subordination, the fact that it exists within every type of social and economic arrangement and in societies of every degree of complexity, indicates to me that we are up against something very profound, very stubborn, something we cannot root out simply by rearranging a few tasks and roles in the social system or even by reordering the whole economic structure. I would flatly assert that we find women subordinate to men in every known society. The search for a genuine egalitarian, let alone matriarchal culture, has proved fruitless. It is the divine order. We are what we are by godly mandate, and it is reflected sociologically, anthropologically, historically to be the case." Now, when I have said all this about a man accepting his role under mandate from God, we are prepared for the task because God has created us so, and we're under mandate and authority to do it. We don't have a choice. We cannot abandon our responsibility to lead. And if we do abandon that responsibility to that extent, we cease to be men. We're not talking about autocratic tyranny. This is not some Rambo manifestation of violence. God forbid. And it's certainly no Archer Bunker Cloddish mentality without any sense or sensitivity. We're talking about leadership that God has designed. And you know good and well, if you have any understanding of the nature of God at all, that he would never put anyone in a role of leadership from whom he did not demand the same disposition, attitude, and set of values that he's manifested in his own leadership of this universe. And we're going to say more about that in just a moment. It's sad what we've done. And it's all because we thought ourselves so smart and so intelligent and so much in charge that it didn't make any difference what we did. Things would go along very well. They have not, and they will not. Now, I want to look at another mark of a man. A man and his wife. It's not good for man to be alone. I will make a help suitable for him, said God. And so he has done. And so he has done marvelously well. As certainly as men are created and designed for their task, women are designed admirably for their own. They are the climax of the divine creation. They are special, wonderful, marvelous. And when we talk about leadership, I want it to be understood at the very outset, we are not talking about superiority. We are not talking about greater importance. We're not talking about some gradation of significance. We're only talking about a role. I don't know why it is that feminists don't seem to get up in arms because the Son, who is God in every aspect, is submissive to his Father, who is God in every aspect. But who have a strong resistance to the idea that the woman should be submissive to the man because they find it demeaning and diminishing. If there's any lesson that God has sought to teach us in what we have memorialized today, it is this. That in leading, we submit ourselves to the needs of other people. It is not a way of asserting your way and obtaining your desires. It is a way of yielding your way and yielding your desires in a selfless fashion for the sake of others. And that's all it needs. Ephesians 5, 22 to 29, 1 Peter 3 and verse 7 tells us that a man is to lead. The husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, that section begins. But he is to lead lovingly. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for it. He is to lead in such a way that he yields himself, whether in the way he lives or, if necessary, by the way he dies, protecting and preserving and sheltering his wife. Women are made to need that. We are made with the responsibility to provide it, leading with love. As Ephesians 5:21 says so clearly, subjecting yourselves one to another in the fear of Christ. Because we reverence Christ, we subject all our wishes and desires to the needs of our wives, and we so lead that they will be enlarged, protected, fulfilled, because that's the aim. I don't think we ever got past Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's statement in Hiawatha, when he took the bow that projects the arrow as a model of the male-female relationship. As unto the bow the cord is, so unto man is woman. Though she bends him, she obeys him. Though she draws him, yet she follows. Useless each without the other. Man and woman,
husband and wife, create a unity in which each fulfills his or her role. Now, not only does he lead lovingly, but he knows thoroughly, as 1 Peter 3, verse 7 says. Let the man dwell with his wife according to knowledge. We must be aware of the fact that men and women are different. Stu Weber, in his book, Tender Warrior, made the observation about a headline, Time Magazine, front page news back in 1992, I think in January, that showed a little boy flexing his muscles and a young girl looking admiringly on this movement. And it said, latest news. Why are men and women different? They were made that way. Flash. First of all, that we're different. Secondly, they were made that way. There's a difference between men and women. God ordained difference. We don't think quite the same. Our approach to things, not the same. Men tend to compartmentalize everything, and women think with connectedness. Like the way you behave this morning is connected with what's going to happen tonight. And a man doesn't think there's any connection. What's all this about? Men are task-oriented. And we made the observation, we talked about our relationship with each other, that the only way in the world you can get two men into a conversation of any depth is we got to do something together. We got to play a game, we've got to do a job, and then maybe we'll get to talking. But the idea that a man would call up another man and say, I'm coming over just to visit with you for a while, unbelievable. Unbelievable. We'd know if somebody said that to us, what's the problem? Something's up. But a woman would just, I'll just come by and see me. Let's talk. And they will. As men are task-oriented, so women are relationship-oriented. We're different. And I want to say this, try as we will, we're going to stay that way. But we can move toward each other in understanding. A man is the leader, though, and it's his task and responsibility to understand the needs of his wife. That she needs tenderness, that she must be nurtured, that she must be kept, that she must be protected, that she must be provided for. That is not condescending. It's the way it is. It's our task. It's our privilege to do it. It's our responsibility, our God-given responsibility to do it. And not only that, honor her, says Peter, as the weaker vessel. He will give honor to the woman as the weaker vessel. In his leadership, he will honor her. That expression, I think, is certainly given in the 31st chapter of Proverbs, where King Lemuel is being given by his mother what I judge to be a portrait of the kind of woman you ought to seek for a wife. And it begins by saying, in verse 10, a worthy woman who can find, for her price is far above rubies. She is priceless. And then this word in verse 28, her children rise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her, saying, many daughters have done worthily, but you excel them all. How long has it been? How long has it been that we have said, you are wonderful. You are special. Grace is deceitful. Beauty is vain. But a woman that fears the Lord, she shall be praised. She ought to be praised. She ought to be honored. Honored for her work's sake as she tends the necessities of daily life in the home and uses skills that men do not possess, at least not in that measure, to do it. And that every man recognize that the fact that the wife does not go into the marketplace, which has been destroying the home in many ways, because those early years of nurture are stolen from couples by babysitter.
I'm telling you, we wouldn't put our automobile into such inexpert hands. I'd be more concerned to check out the mechanic than sometimes I am to check out childcare. Let me say this to you, that the one most able to care for the child is the mother. And I will add to this, you will note before we're through, and the father. But I want the man to recognize, and I want you to hear me well, that half of what you earn economically is the product of your wife's investment. She's not hired help, inexpert labor, so that you can spend the money any way you please, but she dare not spend $10 without coming before the Supreme Court. I have learned this lesson, I hope. She's to be honored for her work's sake. And her labor is to be treasured. And he must cherish her deeply. That's said in the 5th chapter of Ephesians, as he proceeds to observe that we are one flesh, and that a woman is of his own flesh and blood, and no man ever injured his own body, but nourishes and cherishes it. She is to be cherished as a delicate but magnificent creation of God, and the one that he has given you as your own fulfilling companion. She is to be cherished. Is this leadership? This is leadership. This is responsibility. This is caring. This is selflessness. Can we run from this? Can we say it's unpleasant? I don't like it. You can't do it. And in the day that you cease to be what you ought to be toward your wife, you cease to be a man. And I want to tell you that when you, by virtue of your superior strength, push around and bully a woman, you are below or beneath contempt. This is not manliness. Nothing manly about it. Manliness is courage, fidelity, strength, doggedness, getting in the battle and staying in it, staying in the trenches to do what needs to be done, even though it may be unpleasant at times. Loving when we are not loved. Honoring and respecting, even if we are not honored and respected. We are not told to subjugate our wives. We are told to guide and lead. All right. Now the last. The marks of a man and his children. The absence of fathers is killing this society. And we've been, by virtue of our cultural dispositions, trying to destroy every last one of them. They have no sense of who they are. Men are cut to pieces, made irresponsible, a relic of the situation. The society continues to blast them with the thought that they're really sort of unneeded appurtenances. They're interesting, but not necessary. I wanted to read you something that was written by a woman. You know, we think about fathers being important to sons, and that's right. You know, a little boy can't learn how to be a man. His mother will try to teach him something, but he cannot learn to be a man unless there's a father to show him what a man is. But think about little girls. My dad was what I thought was a real man. He was a provider and worked hard for our physical needs. He had to go 150 miles away from home to find work, coming home often, only on weekends, as could be expected. I didn't know my dad very well. When I reached adolescence, I began to desire more than anything to win his approval. It became an all-consuming need. I went back and forth from being a tomboy to being feminine to try to get him to like me. I took up fishing and made myself pull worms apart and get slime underneath my fingernails, so that I could bait my own hooks and we could go fishing, but he didn't have time to go fishing anymore. I started playing softball and became the best pitcher in our school, but he never saw me play a game.
I worked hard to get straight A's and was always on the honor roll. Never once did he say he was proud of me. One year I was a cheerleader. He never came to a game. One year I was captain of the drill team. He never saw a performance. One weekend I tried to help him work on the car, but he was cross with me and I was in the way, and I went into the house and made some cookies. He said I baked them too long. More and more I found myself retreating to my room on the weekend, sobbing violently, desperately wanting him to care. Not once did he comfort me. He never read to me. He never tucked me into bed. He never hugged me. He never kissed me. He never said, I love you. I got married and had four kids. The last one was a boy, the only male descendant. We gave him his name. He was not impressed. Restless and dissatisfied with mothering, I went back to school. Somehow, without meaning to, I found myself studying civil engineering, the field of study closest to his profession. I worked as a surveyor last year, laying out lines just like the lines he had put in for years. I found myself thinking, if he could see me now, he'd be proud of me. What a power a father has over the direction of a daughter's life, good or bad, present or absent. He's going to have an influence that lasts a lifetime. I think a lot of fathers leave their daughters to the mothers to raise, thinking a man's influence isn't necessary for girls. I'm 37 years old. I'm beginning to see how much I am still compelled by a deep craving within to gain the approval of this most significant man. You see, if my own father doesn't think I'm worthwhile, I must be worthless. If my own father can't accept me, then I'm unacceptable. If my own father cannot love me, then I must be totally unlovable. If I'm truly worthless and unacceptable and unlovable, then God couldn't love me. And certainly my dear husband, who is only human, couldn't love me either. Mark it now. Not for sons only, but for daughters. Fathers are vital. They are the leaders and the nurturers. They are responsible. Ephesians 6:4 is addressed not to the mother. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. But they are addressed to fathers. To fathers. Why? Because as certainly as the father was responsible, the husband responsible in the Garden of Eden for not having properly guided and led his wife, you hearken to your wife. So also the father is responsible for the nurturing and guidance of his children. We are not allowed to turn over that task to our wives and busy ourselves with our occupation. That is not allowed. Discussions had in Columbus this past day indicated that perhaps even in our work in local churches, we have kept men out of the classroom for small children. Maybe that's all right, maybe it's not. But what it might reflect is that in the homes, fathers are abandoning their responsibility until they think, well, when they get tough. I mean, we are not leaders, we are just part of the fire department. Call me when the house is on fire and I'll see what I can do. The first thing that a man has, if he's a man in a home, is he's got a vision of where he wants his children to go and what he wants them to be. And he has that vision in his heart before ever they come into the world. And that vision is the same vision that our Heavenly Father had for His children, and that is, we know that all things work together for good to them that love God and are called according to His purpose. He had a purpose. For whom He foreknew, knew ahead of time there'd be such children. Whom He foreknew, He also foreordained to be conformed to the image of His Son, that He might be the firstborn of many brethren. Romans 8, verses 28 and 29. He had a dream, He had a vision. Every father, if he's a man, has a vision for his children. He is not just a procreating instrument. It doesn't take anything to bring a child into the world. That doesn't make you a man. Some people seem to think so. If they can bring a string of children into the world, somehow or another, their masculinity is affirmed. In fact, it's their stupidity and irresponsibility that's affirmed in that they do not have the courage and the responsibility to care for those that they've brought into the world and they've had no dream nor design for them. That is ungodly. And it's not manly. And it's not courageous. Lead with a vision. Lead by example. It's not enough just to have a vision. We're going to have to present to these children exactly what we want them to be. We must be called of God too. We must be seen to be men of God. We must be seen to be those who reverence God. It is not unmanly to fall on our faces before one who's the ruler and creator of the universe. It would be stupid not to do so. And every man who's trying to strut his way across the stage of life without recognizing the importance of acknowledging the greatness of God who gives him his manhood, who gives him his manhood, is committing folly. And so he must lead by example. It's not enough to be a gospel preacher and go home and act like a fool in front of your children. It's not enough to teach a Bible class and leave every principle that was ever raised in that Bible class completely in the book and go acting carelessly, selfishly, impulsively, and angrily at home. You can't bring your children to every Bible class up here and every assembly up here and act a different way at home and in daily life and expect that to be anything other than the destruction of your children. You are a hypocrite. And you must lead as a servant. All through these admonitions in Ephesians 5 and 6. Wife, be submissive to your husband. Husband, love your wives. As Christ loved the church. Children, obey your parents in the Lord. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Servants, obey your masters. Masters, remember you've got a master in heaven. They're all saying that those who lead must lead selflessly, lead as servants, lead as those who would serve others. So God leads us. God is not leading us for His own advantage. All His commandments are for our good always, says Moses in Deuteronomy 6:24. There is not one of them that's grievous or burdensome or arbitrary, says 1 John 5, verse 3. God is speaking to us. God is leading us. God is guiding us. God is nurturing us always, not for Himself, but for us. For us. And so we must lead our children, and we must lead by nurture. There are the practical daily tasks that we've got to work out so that we figure out how we're going to teach our children to love God. First thing, loving God ourselves, and it being apparent that we love God. More than anything. That means something to us, that that's the highest value in our lives. And secondly, that we love them. And because we love them, we guide them. Guide them sometimes in ways that they don't want to go. Always, though, in everything we do, we assure them that we care for them, that they're important. And if we disapprove their conduct, we never say to them ever that we disapprove them and we deny them. We never reject them. We'll always love them. We will always love them. But we will teach them and nurture them into godly ways that will make them a blessing to themselves and to other people. That is our dream. That is our aim. It's got to be done day after day after day. And fathers have got to be a part of this. They need to lead in the arrangement for training and teaching, worship, prayer, Bible study. They need to lead in acts of goodness. Take their sons and their daughters. We've expected the mother to do that. I know. I grew up with a similar blindness. We've got to get involved. We are responsible. We're the ones called upon to see that this is done. I'm sure there's more that can be said, as you may want to observe, Earnhardt can do it. But this is enough for now. Quit you like men. It's not an easy task. I know that. But it's what we were made for. It's what we were made for. And I do believe with all my heart, because I trust in the arrangements of God, that if we will behave ourselves courageously as men ought, our wives will be enabled, aided, to become all that God intended them to be. And our children, they too, will become that. We are battling the culture to achieve this. Face that fact. We have no allies out there by and large. But that doesn't matter. Because God, who created us and who rules over this world, He is on our side. Be strong. Show yourself a man. That's the exhortation. If you're not a Christian, young man, if you ever want to be a man, you're going to find out about manhood from God and from His Son. Young lady, if you won't ever be a woman in all the beauty
of the possibilities of that, you need to be a Christian. He's the one, your Father, who can help you understand what that means and help you to achieve it. To those of you who are fathers now, to those of you who are mothers now, and you're not serving God, you need to think about this. So much is at stake. Even grandfathers and grandmothers who have the power to bless others. I appreciated what Weber said in his book, that even men who are not biological parents, even men who are not married, have within themselves the fathering instinct and the capability, and they need to be fathered. Those of us who don't have children need to be helping to father and nurture other children. And I want to tell you, I make it a point, maybe sometimes for the wrong reason. I said, if little children care anything about you, you can't be a total loss. That's what the old gospel preacher told me. But I speak to children because I treasure them. I speak to young people even when they don't speak to me because I treasure them and I want them to know that they are significant. I'd like somehow, even for young people that I touch in passing, to be enlarged in their understanding of who they are and what they can achieve by the power of God, by any little influence I can have. We all can do that, men. We all can father. Paul said, my beloved child, Timothy. He was the father of many. Whatever your need may be this morning, receive the grace of God. Come and do what you need to do in order to please Him. Be reconciled to Him. Serve Him like you ought while we're standing and singing.